out from under her tutelage, Férula began to dislike him. His freedom to come and go stung her like a reproach, like an injustice. When he fell in love with Rosa and Férula saw how desperate he was, like a little boy begging for her help, needing her, following her around the house, pleading with her to intercede on his behalf for the Del Valle family, that she speak to Rosa, that she bribe Nana, she again felt important to her brother. For a time, they seemed to have been reconciled. But that rapprochement did not last long, and Férula was quick to realize that she had been used. She was happy when she saw her brother leave for the mine. From the time he had begun to work, when he was 15, Esteban had supported the household and had promised always to do so. But for Férula, that had not been enough. It bothered her to have to stay locked up within these walls that stank of medicine and age, to be kept awake at night by the moans of her sick mother, always attentive to the clock, so as to administer each dose at the proper time, bored, tired, and unhappy, while her brother had no taste of such obligations. Before him lay a destiny that was bright, free, and full of promise. He could marry, have children, know what love was. The day she sent the telegram telling him of Rosa's death, she had felt a strange shiver, almost of joy. "You'll have to work at something," Férula repeated. "You'll never lack for anything so long as I live," he said. "That's easy to say," Férula replied, drawing a fishbone from between her teeth. "I think I'm going to go to the country, maybe to Tres Marias." "That place is in ruins, Esteban. I've always told you that the best thing you could do with it is sell it, but you're as stubborn as a mule. Land is something one should never sell. It's the only thing that's left when everything else is gone."
"I don't agree. Land is a romantic idea. What makes a man rich is a good eye for business," Férula insisted.
"But you always said that one day you would go and live in the country."
"That day has arrived. I hate this city."
"Why don't you say it's because you hate this house?"
"That too," he answered brutally.
"I would like to have been born a man so I could leave too," she said, full of hatred.
"And I would not have liked to be a woman," he said. They finished eating in silence. The brother and sister had drifted apart, and the only thing that remained to unite them was the presence of their mother, and the vague memory of the love they had had for each other as children. They had grown up in a ruined home, witness to the moral and economic deterioration of their father, and then the slow illness of their mother. Doña Esther had begun to suffer from arthritis at an early age, becoming stiffer and stiffer, until she could only move with the greatest difficulty, like a living corpse. Finally, no longer able to bend her knees, she had settled for good into her wheelchair, her widowhood, and her despair. Esteban remembered his childhood and adolescence, his tight-fitting suits, the rope of St. Francis he was forced to tie around his waist as a sign of who only knew what vows his mother or his sister had made, his carefully mended shirts, and his loneliness. Férula, 5 years his senior, washed and starched his only two shirts every other day so that he would always look fresh and properly dressed, and reminded him that on their mother's side, they were heir to the noblest and most high-born surname of the vice-royalty of Lima. Trueba had simply been a regrettable accident in the life of Doña Esther, who was destined to marry someone of her own class. But she had fallen hopelessly in love with that good-for-nothing immigrant, a first-generation settler who within a few short years had squandered first her dowry and then her inheritance. But his blue blood past was of no use to Esteban if there was not enough money in the house to pay the grocer, and he had to go to school on foot because he did not have the fare for the streetcar. He recalled how they had packed him off to school with his chest and back lined with newspaper, because he had no woolen underclothes and his overcoat was in tatters, and how he had suffered at the thought that his schoolmates might be able to hear, as he could, the crunch of the paper as it moved against his skin. In winter, the only source of heat in the whole house was the brazier in his mother's bedroom, where the three of them huddled together to save on candles and coal. His had been a childhood of privations, discomfort, harshness, interminable nighttime rosaries, fear, and guilt. All that remained of those days was his fury and his outsized pride. 2 days later, Esteban Trueba left for the country. Férula accompanied him to the train station. She kissed him a cold goodbye on the cheek and waited for him to board the train carrying his two leather suitcases with the bronze locks, the same ones he had bought when he left for the mine and that were supposed to last him the rest of his life, according to the salesman's promise. She told him to be sure to take care of himself and to try to visit them from time to time. She said she would miss him, but they both knew they were destined not to see each other for many years, and underneath it all, they were both rather relieved. "Let me know if Mother takes a turn for the worse," Esteban shouted through the window as the train pulled out. "Don't worry," Férula replied, waving her handkerchief from the platform. Esteban Trueba leaned back in the red velvet seat and felt deep gratitude to the British, who had had the foresight to build first-class cars in which one could travel like a gentleman, without having to put up with chickens, baskets, string-tied bundles, and the howls of other people's children. He congratulated himself for having decided on the more expensive ticket for the first time in his life, and observed that this was one of the details that marked the difference between a yokel and a gentleman. He decided that from that day on, no matter how tight his circumstances, he would always pay for the small comforts that made him feel rich. "I don't plan to be poor ever again," he decided, dreaming of the seam of gold. Through the window of the train, he watched the passing landscape of the Central Valley. Vast fields stretched from the foot of the mountain range, a fertile countryside filled with vineyards, wheat fields, alfalfa, and marigolds. He compared it with the sterile plateaus of the north, where he had spent 2 years stuck in a hole in the midst of a rough and lunar horizon, whose terrifying beauty never ceased to interest him. He had been fascinated by the colors of the desert, the blues, the purples, the yellows of the minerals lying on the surface of the earth. "My life is changing," he said softly. He closed his eyes and fell asleep. He got off the train at the station of San Lucas. It was a wretched place. At that hour of the morning, there was not a soul on the wooden platform, its roof eaten away by inclement weather and ants. From where he stood, he could see the whole valley through an impalpable mist that rose from the earth the night rain had soaked. The distant mountains disappeared behind the clouds of a shrouded sky. Only the snowy peak of the volcano could be seen in all its clarity, outlined against the landscape and lit by a timid winter sun. He looked around him. In his childhood, during the only happy time he could recall, before his father slid utterly into ruin and abandoned himself to alcohol and disgrace, the two of them had gone horseback riding in this part of the country. He remembered that he played during the summers at Tres Marias, but it was all so long ago that memory had almost erased it, and he did not recognize the place. He combed the landscape for the town of San Lucas, but was only able to make out a far-off hamlet that was faded in the dampness of the morning. He walked around the station. There was a padlock on the door to the only office. There was a penciled note tacked on it, but it was so smudged that he could not read it. He heard the train pull out behind him, leaving a column of white smoke. He was alone in the silent landscape. He picked up his bags and stepped out into the mud and stones of a path that led into the town. He walked for more than 10 minutes, grateful that it was not raining, because it was only with great difficulty that he managed to advance along the path with his heavy suitcases, and he realized that the rain had rapidly converted it into an impassable mud hole. As he neared the hamlet, he saw smoke in several of the chimneys and breathed a sigh of relief, for it was so lonely and decayed, he had feared it was a ghost town. He stopped at the edge of town and saw no one. Silence reigned on the only street, which was lined with modest adobe houses, and he felt as if he were walking in his sleep. He approached the nearest house, which had no windows. The door was open. Leaving his bags on the sidewalk, he stepped inside, calling out in a loud voice. It was dark inside because the only source of light was the door, and it took his eyes several seconds to adjust. Then he was able to make out two children playing on the hard earth floor, staring at him with great, astonished eyes, and beyond them, in a courtyard, a woman walking toward him, wiping her hands on the edge of her apron. When she saw him, she made an instinctive motion to arrange a lock of hair that had fallen over her forehead. He greeted her, and she replied, covering her mouth with her fingers as she spoke, to hide her toothless gums. Trueba explained that he needed to rent a cart, but she appeared not to understand him, and only stood there, hiding the children in her apron, with a vacant expression. He walked out the door, picked up his bags, and set out on his way again. When he had walked nearly around the entire town without seeing anyone, and was just beginning to grow desperate, he heard the hooves of a horse behind him. It was a rickety cart, driven by a woodcutter. Trueba stood in front of it, forcing the driver to stop. "Can you drive me to Tres Marias? I'll pay you handsomely," he shouted. "What takes you there, sir?" the man replied. "That place is just a lawless heap of rocks, a no-man's land." But he agreed to take him, and helped him arrange his suitcases among the bundles of wood. Trueba sat down beside him on the coachman's seat. Here and there, children darted out of doorways as they heard the wagon pass. Trueba felt lonelier than ever. About 5 miles outside the town of San Lucas, along a ruined path overgrown with weeds and full of potholes, there was a wooden sign with the name of the property. It hung from a broken chain, and the wind knocked it against the post with a muffled sound that made it echo like a funeral drum. A single glance was enough to make him understand that it would take a Hercules to rescue the place from desolation. The weeds had swallowed up the path, and wherever he looked, all he saw were rocks, thick underbrush, and mountains. There was not even a suggestion of pasture or of the vineyards he remembered, and no one came out to greet him. The cart moved slowly, following the tracks that the passage of men and beasts had carved into the mass of weeds. After a moment, he was able to make out the main house, which was still standing, although it looked like something from a nightmare, full of rubble, with chicken wire and garbage strewn across the floor. Half the tiles on the roof were broken, and a wild tangle of vines had grown through the windows and covered most of the outside wall. Around the house stood several windowless adobe huts. They had not been whitewashed and were black with soot. Two dogs were fighting ferociously in the courtyard. The rattle of the cartwheels and the woodcutter's curses roused the inhabitants of the huts, who gradually emerged from their doorways. They stared at the new arrivals with amazement and mistrust. It had been 15 years since they had seen an owner, and they had simply assumed that there no longer was one. They could not have recognized in this tall, imperious man the little boy with chestnut curls who had played in this same courtyard many years before. Esteban stared back at them, and likewise remembered no one. They were a sorry lot. He saw various women of indecipherable age, their skin dry and cracked, some apparently pregnant, all of them barefoot and dressed in faded rags. He calculated that there must be at least a dozen children of all sizes and ages. The youngest ones were naked. Other faces peered from the doorways, too timid to come out. A few children scampered to hide behind the women. Esteban stepped down from the cart, unloaded his two bags, and pressed a few coins into the woodcutter's hand.
"I'll wait for you if you like, patron," the man said.
"This is as far as I'm going." He walked up to the house, gave the door a single forceful push, and went in. There was enough light inside because morning entered through the broken shutters and the chinks in the ceiling where the tiles had fallen through. The place was full of dust and spider webs and looked thoroughly abandoned. Clearly, in all these years, none of the tenant farmers had dared to leave his hut to move into the large, empty house of the absent owner. They had not touched the furniture. It was all as it had been when he was a child. Each piece exactly where it had stood before, except uglier and more lugubrious and rickety than he remembered. The entire house was carpeted with a thick layer of grass, dust, and dried-out leaves. It smelled like a tomb. A skeletal dog barked angrily at him, but Esteban Trueba paid him no attention until the dog, too tired to continue, lay down in a corner to scratch his fleas. Esteban put his bags on a table and set out to walk through the house, fighting off the sadness that was beginning to overwhelm him. He went from one room to another, noticing how time had worn everything away, and the poverty and dirt, and it seemed to him that this was a hole far worse than the mine. The kitchen was a wide, filthy room, with a high ceiling and walls blackened with smoke from the wood and coal stoves, moldy and in ruins. The copper pots and pans that had not been used for 15 years, apparently untouched in all that time, still hung from their nails. The bedrooms had the same beds and huge wardrobes with full-length glasses that his father had bought long ago, but the mattresses were a pile of rotten wool in which bugs had nested for generations. He heard the faint passage of the rats in the rafters. He could not tell if the floors were made of wood or tiles, because they were invisible, completely covered with grime. A layer of gray dust blurred the contours of the furniture. Where the drawing room had been, he could still see the German piano, with one broken leg and yellow keys, which sounded like an untuned harpsichord. On the shelves, there were still a few illegible books, their pages chewed up by the damp, and on the floor, there were the remnants of ancient magazines whose pages had been scattered by the wind. The armchairs sat with their springs sticking out, and there was a mouse nest in the wing chair where his mother had liked to knit before her illness turned her hands to claws. When he finished his tour, Esteban had a clearer view of things. He knew that an immense task lay ahead of him, for if the house was in such bad repair, he could scarcely expect the rest of the property to be in any better condition. For a second, he was tempted to pile his two bags back on the cart and return whence he had come. But he rejected that plan in a flash and resolved that if there was anything that could alleviate the grief and rage of Rosa's loss, it would be breaking his back working in this ruined land. He took off his coat, drew a deep breath, and went out into the courtyard where the woodcutter was still waiting, not far from the tenants who had grouped themselves at a certain distance with the shyness typical of country people. They looked at each other with curiosity. Trueba took two steps toward them and noticed a slight backward movement in the tiny cluster. He let his eyes wander over the shabby peasants and tried to force a friendly smile to the runny-nosed children, the bleary-eyed old people, and the women without hope, but it came out like a grimace. "Where are the men?" he asked. The only young man stepped forward. He was probably the same age as Esteban Trueba, but he looked older. "They left," he said. "What's your name?"
"Pedro Segundo Garcia, sir," the man replied.
"I'm the patron here now. The party's over. We're going to work. Anyone who doesn't like the idea should clear out immediately.
Whoever stays won't lack for food, but he'll have to work good and hard. I don't want any deadbeats or smart alecks around, you understand?
They looked at one another in amazement. They had not understood half of what he said, but they could recognize their master's voice when they heard it.
We understand, patron, Pedro Segunda Garcia said. We have nowhere to go. We've always lived here. We'll stay.
A little boy squatted on the ground and began to defecate, and a mangy dog ran up to sniff him. Revolted, Esteban ordered them to take the child away, hose the courtyard down, and kill the dog. Thus began the new life that, in time, would make him forget Rosa.
No one's going to convince me that I wasn't a good patron. Anyone who saw Tres Marias in decline and who could see it now when it's a model estate would have to agree with me. That's why I can't go along with my granddaughter's story about class struggle, because when it comes right down to it, those poor peasants are a lot worse off today than they were 50 years ago. I was like a father to them. Agrarian reform ruined things for everyone. I used all the money I had saved to marry Rosa and everything the foreman sent me from the mine to pull Tres Marias out of misery. But it wasn't money that saved the place. It was hard work and organization. The word went out that there was a new patron at Tres Marias and that we were using mules to clear the land of stones and plow the fields to ready them for planting. In no time at all, men began to arrive, offering their service as hired hands, because I paid well and gave them meals. I bought animals. Animals were sacred to me. And even if we had to go a year without eating meat, they were never killed. Thus, our livestock prospered. I organized the men into different crews, and after they had finished working in the fields, we set to work on restoring the main house. They weren't carpenters or masons, and I had to teach them everything from books I bought. We even did the plumbing. We fixed the roofs, whitewashed the house from top to bottom, and cleaned it inside and out until it sparkled. I distributed the furniture among the various tenants, except the dining room table, which was still intact despite the worms that had got into everything, and the wrought iron bed that had belonged to my parents. I continued living in the empty house with no other furniture apart from those two pieces and a few wooden crates to sit on until Ferula sent me the new furniture I had ordered from the capital. They were large, heavy, ostentatious pieces that were built to last for generations and to withstand country life. The proof is that it took an earthquake to destroy them. I arranged them along the walls, with an eye more to convenience than aesthetics, and once the house was comfortable, I felt happy and began to get used to the idea that I was going to spend many years, perhaps even my whole life, in Tres Marias. The tenants' wives took turns as servants in the main house, and they also tended my orchard. I soon saw the first flowers in the garden I had planned out with my own hand, and that, with a few minor changes, is the same one that's there today. In those days, people worked without grumbling. I think my presence made them feel secure again. They saw the land gradually restored to prosperity. They were good, simple men, with no rebels among them. It's also true that they were very poor and very ignorant. Before I got there, they were just tilling their own small family plots, which provided them with the bare necessities to keep from starving to death, providing, of course, that they weren't struck by some catastrophe such as drought, frost, plague, ants, or snails, in which case things became very difficult indeed. But after I arrived, all that changed. One by one, we rescued the old fields. We rebuilt the chicken coops and stables and began to plan an irrigation system so the crops wouldn't have to depend on the weather. But it wasn't an easy life. It was very hard. Sometimes I would walk to town and return with a veterinarian who would check the cows and hens and, while he was at it, anybody who was sick. It's not true that I assumed that if the vet knew how to treat animals, his training was good enough for people, as my granddaughter says when she wants to get me mad. The fact is, you couldn't get a doctor in a godforsaken place like that. The peasants went to an Indian curandera who knew all about the power of herbs and suggestion, and in whom they had great confidence, more than in the vet. Mothers gave birth with help from their neighbors, prayers, and a midwife who almost never arrived on time because she had to make the trip by burro, but she was as good at delivering babies as she was at pulling calves from wall-eyed cows. Those who were gravely ill, whom no spell of the curandera or potion from the vet could help, were placed on a cart and taken by Pedro Segundo Garcia or me to a hospital run by nuns, where there was frequently a doctor who helped them die. The dead and their bones ended up in a tiny graveyard next to the abandoned church at the foot of the volcano, where there is now a proper cemetery. Once or twice a year I arranged for a priest to come and bless unions, animals, and machines, baptize children, and say a belated prayer for the dead. The only amusement, then, was castrating pigs and bulls, cockfights, hopscotch, and the incredible tales of old Pedro Garcia, may he rest in peace. He was Pedro Segundo's father, and he said his grandfather had fought in the ranks of the patriots who kicked the Spaniards out of America. He showed the children how to let themselves be stung by spiders and drink the urine of pregnant women as a form of immunization. He knew almost as many herbs as a curandera, but he would get confused when it came to deciding on their use, and he had committed some irreparable mistakes. Nonetheless, I have to say that he had an unbeatable method for pulling teeth, which had made him justly famous throughout the region. It was a combination of red wine and Our Fathers, which plunged the patient into a hypnotic trance. He pulled one of my molars, and if he were alive today, he would be my dentist. I soon felt at home in the country. My closest neighbors were a good horse ride away, but I wasn't interested in having a social life. I enjoyed my solitude, and besides, I had a lot of work on my hands. I gradually became a savage. I began to forget words, my vocabulary grew smaller, and I became very demanding. Since I had no need to keep up appearances, the bad character I've always had only got worse. Everything made me angry. I got furious if I saw the children circling the kitchen to steal bread, if the hens were noisy in the courtyard, if sparrows invaded the cornfields. When my ill humor began to bother me and I felt uncomfortable in my own skin, I would go out hunting. I would wake up long before dawn and leave with my shotgun on my shoulder, with my game bag and my partridge hound. I liked to ride horseback in the dark, and I liked the cold air of those early hours, the long wait in the shadows, the silence, the smell of gunpowder and blood, the feel of the weapon drawn back against my shoulder with a dry knock, and the sight of the prey as it fell kicking. All this would calm me, and when I returned from hunting with four wretched rabbits in my pouch and a few partridges so full of holes that they couldn't even be cooked, half dead on my feet and covered with mud, I felt happy and relieved. Whenever I think back on those days, I feel a great sadness. My life has gone by very fast. If I had it to do over again, there are a few mistakes I wouldn't make. But in general, there's nothing I regret. Yes, I've been a good patron. There's no doubt about it.
The first months, Esteban Trueba was so busy channeling water, digging wells, removing stones, clearing pastures, and repairing the chicken coops and stables that he had no time to think about anything. He went to bed thoroughly exhausted and woke at dawn, stopping just long enough to eat a meager breakfast in the kitchen before riding off to supervise the work in the fields. He did not return until sundown. Only then did he sit down to eat his one real meal of the day, alone at the dining room table. The first months, he kept his promise to himself of always bathing and changing his clothes for dinner, as he had heard the British colonizers did in the most distant hamlets of Africa and Asia, so as not to lose their dignity and authority.
He would put on his best clothes, shave, and play his favorite opera arias on the gramophone. But little by little, he let himself be conquered by rusticity and came to accept the fact that he had no calling as a dandy, especially since there was no one to appreciate his efforts. He stopped shaving, cut his hair only when it reached his shoulders, and continued to bathe once a day only because the habit was so ingrained in him. But he grew indifferent to his clothes and manners. He was slowly becoming a barbarian. Before going to sleep, he would read for a while or play chess. He had developed the ability to compete against a book without cheating and had learned to lose matches without getting mad. Still, the exhaustion produced by so much hard work was not enough to suppress his robust and sensual nature. He began to have difficult nights in which the blankets seemed excessively heavy to him, the sheets too light. His horse played nasty tricks on him, suddenly becoming a formidable female, a hard, wild mountain of flesh on which he rode until his bones ached. The warm, aromatic melons in his orchard looked to him like enormous breasts, and he was astonished to find himself burying his face in his saddle blanket, seeking, in the sour smell of his horse's sweat, the forbidden, distant scent of his first prostitutes. During the night, he sweated through nightmares of rotten shellfish, of enormous slabs of raw beef, of blood, semen, and tears. He would wake up tense, with his penis like an iron rod between his legs, angrier than ever. Hoping for relief, he would run out and plunge naked into the icy waters of the river until he couldn't breathe. But then he would feel invisible hands stroking his legs. Beaten, he would let himself float aimlessly, feeling the hug of the current, the kiss of the tadpoles, the lash of the rushes that grew along the banks. Soon, his terrible need became notorious. Nothing could quench it. Neither immersing himself in the river, nor cinnamon teas, nor placing a piece of flint beneath his mattress. Not even those shameful manipulations that drove the boys in boarding school out of their minds, left them blind, and plunged them into eternal damnation. When he began to look with concupiscent eyes at the birds in the corral, the children playing naked in the orchard, and even at raw bread dough, he understood that his virility would not be soothed by priestly substitutes. His common sense told him that he would have to find a woman, and once he had made up his mind, the terrible anxiety that afflicted him began to ebb, and his fury seemed to abate. That day he woke up smiling for the first time in months. Pedro Garcia, the old man, saw him whistling on his way to the stables and shook his head in wonder. All that day, the patron was busy plowing a field that had just been cleared and that was slated to be planted with corn. Afterward, he went with Pedro Segundo Garcia to attend to a cow that was in the process of giving birth and whose calf was turned the wrong way around. He had to stick his arm in up to the elbow to turn the creature upside down and help it pull its head through. The cow died anyway, but he did not get upset about it. He ordered the calf bottle-fed, washed himself in a pail, and got back on his horse. Normally, it would have been his dinner time, but he was not hungry. He was in no hurry, for he had already made his choice. He had seen the girl many times carrying her sniveling little brother on her hip, with a bag on her shoulder or a water jug on her head. He had watched her washing clothes, squatting on the flat stones of the river, her dark legs polished by the water, as she rubbed the faded rags with her rough peasant hands. She was big-boned and had an Indian face, with broad features, dark skin, and a sweet, peaceful expression. Her fleshy, ample mouth still had all its teeth, and when she smiled, her whole face lit up, but that did not happen very often. She had the beauty of early youth, although he could see that it would quickly fade, as it does with women who are born to have many children, work without rest, and bury their dead. Her name
was Pancha Garcia, and she was 15 years old. When Esteban Trueba went out to look for her, it was already late in the afternoon, and the air was crisp. He rode his horse slowly through the long stretches of green that separated the pastures, asking after her as he went, until he spotted her on the path that led to her hut. She was doubled over beneath the weight of a sheaf of hawthorn for the kitchen hearth, barefoot, her head bowed. He looked at her from high in the saddle and immediately felt the urgent desire that had been tormenting him for so many months. He trotted up until he was right beside her. She heard him, but she continued walking without looking up, following the custom of all the women of her kind who bow their heads before the male. Esteban bent down and removed her burden, held it in the air for a moment, and then hurled it violently to the side of the path. He threw his arm around her waist, swept her up with an animal-like grunt, and placed her before him in the saddle. The girl did not resist. He kicked his heels in the stirrups, and they took off at a gallop in the direction of the river. They dismounted without speaking and looked each other over. Esteban unfastened his broad leather belt, and she stepped back, but he grabbed her with a single stroke of his hand. They fell arm in arm among the eucalyptus leaves. Esteban did not remove his clothes. He attacked her savagely, thrusting himself into her without preamble, with unnecessary brutality. He realized, too late, from the blood spattered on her dress, that the young girl was a virgin. But neither Pancha's humble origin nor the pressing demands of his desire allowed him to reconsider. Pancha Garcia made no attempt to defend herself. She did not complain, nor did she shut her eyes. She lay on her back, staring at the sky with terror, until she felt the man drop to the ground beside her with a moan. She began to whimper softly. Before her, her mother, and before her, her grandmother, had suffered the same animal fate. Esteban Trueba adjusted his trousers, fastened his belt, helped her to her feet, and lifted her onto the haunches of his horse. They headed back. He was whistling. She continued to weep. Before dropping her off at her hut, the patron kissed her on the lips. "Starting tomorrow, I want you to work in the house," he said. Pancha agreed without looking up. Her mother and her grandmother had also been servants in the main house. That night, Esteban Trueba slept like an angel, without dreaming of Rosa. He woke the next morning full of energy, feeling taller and stronger. He set off for the fields, humming. And when he returned, Pancha was in the kitchen, busily stirring marmalade in a huge copper pot. That night, he waited for her with impatience. And when the sounds of housework fell silent in the old adobe house and the nocturnal scampering of the rats began, he felt the girl's presence in the doorway of his room. "Come, Pancha," he called. It was not an order, but an entreaty. Now Esteban took the time to savor her fully and made sure that she felt pleasure too. He explored her slowly, learning by heart the smoky scent of her body and her clothes, which had been washed with ash and pressed with coal-filled iron. He learned the texture of her straight, dark hair, of her skin that was soft in the most hidden places and rough and calloused everywhere else, of her fresh lips, her tranquil sex, and her broad belly. He desired her calmly, initiating her into the most secret and most ancient of sciences. He was probably happy that night, and the few nights after, as the two of them cavorted like two puppies in the huge wrought iron bed that had belonged to the first Trueba, and was now somewhat wobbly, although it still withstood the thrusts of love. Pancha Garcia's breasts swelled, and her hips filled out. Esteban Trueba's ill humor lifted for a while, and he took a certain interest in his tenants. He went to visit them in their wretched huts. In the shadows of one of them, he came upon a box filled with newspaper, in which a newborn baby and a puppy lay in a shared sleep. In another, he saw an old woman who had been slowly dying for the past 4 years, whose shoulder blades were jutting through the open wounds in her back. In the courtyard, moored to a post, he saw a teenaged idiot with a rope around his neck, drooling and babbling incoherently as he stood there naked, with a mule-sized penis that he beat incessantly against the ground. For the first time in his life, he realized that the worst abandonment of Tres Marias was not that of the land and animals, but of the people, who had lived unprotected ever since his father had gambled away his mother's dowry and inheritance. He decided it was time to bring a bit of civilization to this outpost hidden halfway between the mountains and the sea. A fever of activity commenced that shook Tres Marias from its stupor. Esteban Trueba put people to work as they had never worked in their whole lives, anxious to rescue in the course of a few months what had lain in ruins for years. The patron hired every man, woman, old person, and child who could stand on his own 2 feet. He had a granary built, as well as larders for storing food in winter. He had horse meat salted and pork smoked, and set the women to making fruit preserves. He modernized the dairy, which was just an old shed filled with flies and manure, and forced the cows to produce enough milk to meet his needs. He began construction of a 6-room schoolhouse because he aspired to the day when all the children and adults of Tres Marias would know how to read, write, and do simple arithmetic, even though he was not in favor of their acquiring any additional learning, for fear they would fill their minds with ideas unsuited to their station and condition. Nonetheless, he was unable to obtain a teacher willing to work in such a remote area, and, faced with the difficulty of luring the children to school with promises of lashings and caramels when he tried to teach them to read himself, he finally gave up his dream and relegated the school to other uses. His sister, Ferula, sent him all the books he asked for from the city. They were practical texts, from which he learned to give injections by pricking himself in the leg, and to build a crystal radio set. He spent his first profits on rough cloth, a sewing machine, a box of homeopathic pills with an instruction booklet, an encyclopedia, and a shipment of readers, notebooks, and pencils. He cherished the idea of setting up a dining hall where every child would receive one full course meal a day, so that they would grow up strong and healthy and be able to start work at a tender age. But he realized it was crazy to expect the children to arrive from all ends of the property just for a plate of food. So he transformed the project into a sewing workshop. Pancha Garcia was chosen to decipher the mysteries of the sewing machine. At first, she thought it was an instrument of the devil, endowed with a life of its own, and refused to go anywhere near it. But Esteban was unyielding, and in the end, she mastered it. He also set up a modest general store where the tenants could buy whatever they needed without having to make the trip by ox cart all the way into San Lucas. The patron would buy things wholesale and resell them at cost to his workers. He introduced a voucher system, which at first functioned as a form of credit, but gradually became a substitute for legal tender. With these slips of pink paper, his tenants could buy everything in the general store. Their wages were paid in them. In addition to the famous slips of paper, each worker also had the right to a small plot of land that he could cultivate in his free time, as well as 6 hens a year per family, a measure of seed, a share of the harvest to meet his basic needs, bread and milk for every day, and a bonus of 50 pesos that was distributed among the men at Christmas and on Independence Day. Even though they worked as equals with the men, the women did not receive this sum because, except for widows, they were not considered heads of family. Laundry soap, knitting wool, and a special syrup to strengthen the lungs were distributed free, for Trueba did not want anyone dirty,
cold, or sick, living on his land. One day, he read in the encyclopedia about the advantages of a balanced diet, and so began his mania for vitamins, which was to last for the rest of his life. He had a tantrum whenever he saw any of the peasants giving their children only bread and feeding milk and eggs to the pigs. He began holding required meetings in the schoolhouse to inform them about vitamins and to let them know, in passing, whatever news he managed to pick up on his crystal set. He soon tired of chasing radio waves with his wire and ordered a short-wave radio with two enormous batteries. This apparatus enabled him to intercept a few coherent messages in the midst of a deafening roar from across the sea. Thus it was that he learned about the war in Europe and was able to follow the advances of the troops on a map he hung on the school blackboard, which he marked with pins. The tenants watched him in amazement, without the foggiest idea of why anyone would stick a pin in the color blue one day and move it to the color green the next. They could not imagine the world as the size of a piece of paper spread over a blackboard, in which whole armies were reduced to the head of a pin. In fact, they cared not at all about the war, about scientific inventions, about the advance of industry, the price of gold, or the latest extravaganzas in the world of fashion. These were fairy tales which did nothing to alter the narrowness of their existence. To that undaunted audience, the news on the radio was remote and alien, and the machine lost all its luster for them when it became evident that it was useless when it came to forecasting the weather. The only one who showed the slightest interest in the messages that came through was Pedro Segundo Garcia. Esteban Trueba spent many hours with him, first in front of the crystal set, and then with the battery-operated radio, awaiting the miracle of the distant, anonymous voice that gave them contact with civilization. Even so, this did not bring the two men closer. Trueba knew that this unformed peasant was more intelligent than the others. He was the only one who knew how to read or carry on a conversation more than three sentences long. He was the closest thing to a friend that Trueba had within a radius of 50 miles. But his monumental pride prevented him from recognizing in the man any virtues beyond those that marked him as a good peon. Trueba was not one to encourage intimacy with his subordinates. Pedro Segundo hated him, even though he had never given a name to the tortured feeling that gripped his soul and filled him with confusion. It was a mixture of fear and resentful admiration. His intuition told them that he would never have the courage to confront him face to face, because he was the patrón. He would have to put up with his tantrums, his inconsiderate orders, and his self-importance for the rest of his life. During the years when Tres Marías had been abandoned, Pedro Segundo had naturally assumed command of a small tribe that had survived in these forsaken lands. He had grown used to being respected, to giving orders, to making decisions, and to having no more than the sky over his head. The patron's arrival had changed all that, but he could not deny that they were better off now, for they no longer went hungry, and they were better protected and safer. At times, Trueba thought he caught a glimmer of murderous hatred in his eyes, but there was never cause to rebuke him for any insolence. Pedro Segundo obeyed without complaint and worked without grumbling. He was honest, and he seemed loyal enough. If he saw his sister Pancha in the hall of the main house, walking with the heavy gait of the satisfied woman, he bowed his head and was silent. Pancha Garcia was young, and the patron was strong. The predictable result of their alliance began to show within a few short months. The veins of the young girl's legs suddenly appeared like worms on her dark skin. Her movements slowed, and her gaze grew distant. She lost all interest in the lusty thrashing in the wrought iron bed. Her waist swelled rapidly, and her breasts drooped with the weight of the new life that was growing inside her. Esteban was slow to notice, for he hardly looked at her anymore. his first enthusiasm having waned. He rarely caressed her either. He simply used her as a hygienic method for relieving the tensions of the day and obtaining a good night's sleep. But the moment came when Pancha's pregnancy was obvious, even to him. He felt repulsed by her. He began to see her as an enormous container that held a formless, gelatinous mass that he was unable to view as his own child. Pancha left the main house and returned to her parents' hut, where no one asked her any questions. She continued working in the main house kitchen, kneading dough and sewing on the sewing machine, daily growing more deformed by her maternity. She stopped serving Esteban at the table and avoided running into him, since they no longer had anything to say to one another. A week after she left his bed, he dreamt again of Rosa and awakened on wet sheets. He looked out the window and saw a slender girl hanging up the wash on a wire. She could not have been more than 13 or 14 years old, but she was fully developed. Just then, she turned and looked at him. She had the expression of a woman. Pedro Garcia saw his patron whistling on his way to the stables, and he shook his head in wonder. In the course of the next 10 years, Esteban Trueba became the most respected patron in the region. He built brick houses for his workers, hired a teacher for the school, and raised the standard of living of everyone on his lands. Tres Marias was a good business that required no help from the seam of gold. On the contrary, it served as collateral for an extension on his concession to the mine. Trueba's bad temper became legend and grew so exaggerated that it even made him uncomfortable. He forbade anyone to talk back to him and could tolerate no opposition. He viewed the slightest disagreement as a provocation. His concupiscence also intensified. Not a girl passed from puberty to adulthood that he did not subject to the woods, the riverbank, or the wrought iron bed. When there were no more available women in Tres Marias, he began to chase after those from the neighboring haciendas, taking them in the wink of an eye, anywhere he could find a place in the fields, usually at dusk. He did not bother to hide because he was afraid of no one. On a few occasions, a brother, father, husband or employer showed up at Tres Marias to call him to account, but faced with his uncontrolled violence, these visits in the name of justice or revenge became less frequent. Word of his cruelty spread throughout the region, provoking jealous admiration among the men of his class. The peasants hid their daughters and clenched their fists helplessly because they could not confront him. Esteban Trueba was stronger, and he had impunity. Twice the bullet-riddled bodies of peasants from other haciendas were discovered. There was not the shadow of a doubt in anybody's mind that the guilty one was from Tres Marias, but the rural police simply recorded that bit of information in their record book with the tortured hand of the semi-literate, adding that the victims had been caught committing a theft. The matter never went any further. Trueba continued polishing his reputation as a rake, sowing the entire region with his bastard offspring, reaping hatred, and storing up sins that barely nicked him because he had hardened his soul and silenced his conscience with the excuse of progress. In vain, Pedro Segundo Garcia and the old priest from the nuns' hospital tried to suggest to him that it was not little brick houses or pints of milk that made a man a good employer or an honest Christian, but rather giving his workers a decent salary instead of slips of pink paper, a workload that did not grind their bones to dust, and a little respect and dignity. Trueba would not listen to this sort of thing. It smacked, he said, of communism. "They're degenerate ideas," he muttered. "Bolshevik ideas designed to turn the tenants against me. What they don't realize is that these poor people are completely ignorant and uneducated. They're like children. They can't handle responsibility. How could they know what's best for them? Without me, they'd be lost. If you don't believe me,
Just look what happens every time I turn my back. Everything goes to pieces and they start acting like a bunch of donkeys. They're very ignorant. My people have it fine now. What more do they need? They have everything they want. If they complain, it's out of sheer ingratitude. They have brick houses. I blow their kids' noses and cure their parasites, give them vaccinations and teach them how to read. Is there any other hacienda for miles around that has its own school? No. Whenever I can, I bring a priest in to say mass for them, so I don't see why the priest comes to talk to me about justice. He has no business butting in on matters he doesn't know anything about, and that are outside of his duties. I'd like to see him try to run this property. I wonder if he'd be so high-minded then. You have to use a strong hand on these poor devils. That's the only language they understand. The minute you get soft, they lose their respect. I'm not denying that I've often been severe, but I've always been fair. I've had to teach them everything, even how to eat, because if it were up to them, all they'd eat is bread. If I don't keep an eye on them, they start giving their milk and eggs to the pigs. They don't know how to clean their asses, and they want the right to vote. How are they supposed to know about politics when they don't even know where they live? They're capable of voting for the communists, just like the miners in the north, who might push the whole country over the brink with their strikes. And now, of all times, when the price of copper is at its peak. What I would do up there is send the troops and let some bullets fly, to teach them once and for all. Unfortunately, the only thing that really works in these countries is the stick. This isn't Europe. What you need here is a strong government, with a strong man. It would be lovely if we were all created equal, but the fact is we're not. It couldn't be more obvious. The only one who knows how to work around here is me, and I defy you to prove otherwise. I'm the first one up and the last one to bed in this godforsaken place. If it was up to me, I'd send it all packing and go live like a prince in the capital. But I have to stay here, because if I were to leave for so much as a week, it would all collapse, and these poor creatures would be starving to death again before you know it. Just remember what it was like when I arrived here years ago. A wasteland. It was a ruin filled with rocks and vultures. A no man's land. All the pastures were overgrown. No one had thought of channeling the water. They were satisfied to plant their dirty little lettuce plants in their front yards and let the rest of it sink into misery. I had to come in order for there to be law and order here, and work. How could I be anything but proud? I've worked so well that I've already bought up the two neighboring haciendas. This property is now the biggest and richest in the whole area. An example, the envy of everyone around. A model hacienda. And with the new highway going right alongside us, its value has doubled. If I wanted to sell out, I could go to Europe and live off the interest. But I'm not going anywhere. This is where I plan to stay. Killing myself. I'm doing it for them. If it weren't for me, they'd be lost. If we go to the heart of the matter, they're useless even for running errands. As I've always said, they're like children. There's not one of them can do what he's supposed to do without me there behind him driving him on. And then they started on me with the story that we are all equal. It's enough to make you die laughing. To his mother and sister, he sent crates of fruit, salted meat, hams, fresh eggs, hens both living and in brine, sacks of flour, rice, and other grains, huge wheels of country cheese, and all the money they might need, because he had plenty. Tres Marias and the mine were both producing as they should for the first time since God put them on this planet, as he liked to tell anyone who would listen. He sent Doña Esther and Ferula all sorts of things they had never hoped for in this life. But in all those years, he never found the time to visit them, not even if he was passing through on one of his trips to the north. He was so busy in the fields, with the new land he had bought and the various other businesses on which he had begun to cast his eye, that he had no time to waste at the bedside of an invalid.
Besides, the mails kept them in touch, and the train let him send anything he felt like sending. He had no need to see them.